that cage there, Steve. That monkey'll grab you there in a minute.
Oh, you ain't scared of monkeys, is you?
Yeah, I'm scared of monkeys.
You don't have to be scared of monkeys. Monkeys is the nearest things to human folk.
I wouldn't care.
You learned that in revolution. I suppose you know what revolution is.
Yeah, revolution is a war.
Ain't you talking about the old-style revolution? I'm talking about the new style. Revolution means that a man comes from a monkey.
You don't mean tell me you believe that foolishness.
I didn't believe it at first, but the more I see of you, the suspiciouser I get.
Now, here, don't you call me no monkey.
I didn't call you a monkey.
Well, don't you done it.
I wouldn't call you a monkey.
All right, then.
Well, I wouldn't even stop.
Well, that's all right.
The monkey, I don't know what you is, therefore I don't know what you come from. You is too little for a man and too big for a monkey. Look here, what did you come from anyhow?
I come from Georgia.
I ain't talking about that. I'm talking about your generators. What did you spring from?
Right out in the cotton fields of Georgia.
Boy, you're going to leave the old home today, boy, away. You're going among the city folk to dwell.
Brothers and sisters, greetings. This is the Reverend Marshall Lorenzo Shepherd, Jr., welcoming you to Going North, Tales of the Great Migration, a series of programs on the experiences of Southern blacks who came up from the South to Philadelphia during the early years of this century. Today's show is entitled, The Newcomers.
Oh, my God. You could go to a Broad Street station, and I'm telling you the truth, I've never seen nothing like it. People would be in there like that. Coming from the South. People there meet them and people coming in.
Crosby, Britton.
Oh, it was awful. I never saw nothing like it. And that was every day, and especially on weekend. Yeah, coming in and drove.
The great migration like of Southern blacks to Philadelphia would come in two major waves. The first arriving during World War I, when some 40,000 flocked to the city. And the second major wave concentrated in the early 1920s with the resurgence of industry after severe post-war depression. The height of this second wave came between September 1922 and September 1923, when some 10,000 migrants poured into the city. By 1930, Philadelphia's black population had climbed to 220,000 people, of whom only 30% were born in the state of Pennsylvania. 19% were born in Virginia, the traditional leader, 13% in South Carolina, and 11% in Georgia. The city's black population had increased almost 64% in a single decade and grown from 5% of the city's population in 1910 to about 11% in 1930.
It looked like they were just off the farm. Half of them didn't have no suitcases. They had big bundles, you know, wrapped up in sheet or something, you know, clothes they travel, that's the way they travel. And eat, they brought their lunch, brought their food with them. And, you know, depending on buying nothing, they brought their food right along with them. They'd sit out there and eat, and, you know, in the station yard there, sit there on them bags and whatnot and eat, feed the children. It was pathetic, I'm telling you. But they came, and they stayed. That's the way they came up. They were coming up by the hundreds. And that wasn't just one day, that was for year in and out. Yeah, sure was.
Heading north, you change trains in Washington, D.C., and for the first time sat in the same cars as the white folks. Finally, you were in the north. How exciting it all must have been, heading for a new life in the big city. Visions of good jobs and easy money, the bright lights, and being treated like human beings. Yet not unmindful of lurking dangers and temptations of the big city. And last but not least, fear of the cold weather.
My mother told me when I came here, she said, don't walk close to the walls because they have trap doors,
mm-hmm.
and you will fall in, and somehow you pull you in, and we'll never see you again.
Hattie Alexander.
I was afraid to go in people's house to work on that account,
because
they say like the doctors. They say the doctors would get you,
right?
Because they wanted to
experiment on you.
Mm-hmm. This is what we were told. So many people that go work in people's houses or work in their home,
right.
and say when they walk in, once they get you in there, if you were the type of person that they were looking for, and they would keep walking and say a trap door would mm-hmm. open
right.
and you would fall in the basement and you would never be seen again.
Just...
And so you got to be very careful when you go to Philadelphia. I'll skip.
my parents are when
Arrow
I
Arrow Hunter.
When I left at 16, not yet a young girl, and so they says you're going up north, and it's cold up there. Make sure you always wear your long underwear, because they're always afraid you'll catch tuberculosis. So many people leaving south, going north, and they were coming back with tuberculosis. So, of course, when I left home, they saw that I had on my long underwear. So when I got to my aunt's home, after about a week, I put the long underwear in the drawer, and I haven't had the long underwear on since.
We're wearing them now.
So what was it like for these throngs of newcomers to arrive in the third largest metropolis in the nation, that fabled corner of the promised land? Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
If I tell you the truth, maybe you won't believe it.
Ella Lee.
When I first got to Philadelphia, if I could have took my three children, turned around and went right back to Jacksonville, I would have. In the first place, I wasn't used to living in houses all built together. It seemed to me like when I come here and looked at the way people were living, it seemed like everybody was living in one house. I wasn't used to that. I wasn't used to that. And I was used to when you meet someone, it was, good morning, Mr. So-and-so, or good morning, Aunt So-and-so, or good morning, Brother So-and-so. And it seemed like when you met people, I don't know what you was looking at. And I told my aunt, I said, well, good Lord of mercy, is this what you all call living? And I still haven't really got used to living in Philadelphia. It's still... It's no big hint to me, so far as I'm concerned.
Dixie Dame, that's the name, took me from the land of cotton to that coal-minded north.
Customs and habits in Philadelphia were so different from those in the South. Here, strangers didn't greet each other like they did down home. All the houses were stuck together. The jobs weren't all they were cracked up to be. The stories coming back home, however, had contained such glowing reports that hopes and expectations were sky high. David Amy.
Many stories that had been told to me by some of the boys that had left Durham and come back to visit, they told me the beautiful parts. Now, when I came to Philadelphia, I found that much of it was not the truth. Some of them told me they had nice jobs and doing jobs that when I came, I found that they didn't have that at all. Where they told me they were bartenders, I found out that they were janitors. And that was a disappointment.
People came with widely varying degrees of knowledge about the city. Many of them, straight off the farms with limited education, rural ways, and little or no preparation for urban life, arrived totally ignorant of even the basics of how people lived, ate, dressed, or acted, while others, who had spent time in the cities of the South, felt quite at home. With her brothers away in the service, Minnie was forced to work her parents' farm, and with little hope of relief, she ran away at the tender age of 16 and made her way to relatives in Philadelphia.
I had to get used to knowing how the people ate up here. Down my home, it was like the mid, like our dinner was 12 o'clock. And then dinner was beans, cornbread, and beans wasn't the side dish, that was your regular meal. Then nighttime, maybe she'd make some pancakes or waffles or something and serve. So I was used to that way eating. So when I come up here and they start telling me about dinner at night, it's dinner. I said, that's in the middle of the day when we eat our dinner. So I had to get adjusted to what they had for lunch and what they called dinner at night. And so many things, it was hard for me to get adjusted to.
Learning how to take public transportation, how to use a telephone, how to dress and deport oneself in public, to adjust to work routines determined by the clock, to learn even how to address people, pose real challenges for many folk from the South.
Yes, I remember him coming up. He came up in coveralls and overalls, and you could tell they were from the country, you know. And they would gravitate to the black neighborhoods, which was South Street, from, I guess, from about 8th and 9th Street to Broad Street, and Bainbridge, and Pine, and Lumber, and North End, and Rodman. You'd find them all
the
there.
The South Street corridor had been the heart of black Philadelphia for 100 years. Broad and South was like 125th Street and 7th Avenue in Harlem, or Druid Hill Avenue in Baltimore. It was the one spot, no matter where you came from, that everyone knew. And it was to this section of town that newcomers headed. But though jobs might be falling from the trees, places to live were not, as Ralph Jones remembers.
Dr. Duckery would sign them up down south for jobs, and they came here, they had jobs. But even coming here with jobs, they had no place to stay. And that's where Tinley, my pastor and other pastors, they prevailed upon members of their congregation to rent out extra rooms in their homes, because at that time, black families had a whole house. We didn't live in no apartments, had a house.
Yeah.
And usually the house had one or two extra rooms, and they rented them out, so they charged nominal fees for it. But these men were coming here, they were making more money than ever made in the South in the wartime, and they paid pretty good. And some of them even paid boarding, too, you see. And so the people that they lived with prospered, because they prospered, you see. And many of them, out of the lucrative income they had from these rented rooms and whatnot, they were able subsequently to buy these row houses. And usually, after the ones from South, after they came here and worked, they got enough money to send for the rest of their family, and then they got homes from the South. So that's the burgeoning of the black population in Philadelphia.
And we had places for them to live until they got jobs. And out of the 10, let me see, it was about 5 or 6 came up. And we helped them until they were able to help themselves.
Newly arrived Southerners would lease or buy a large house and then rent rooms, often the family members or friends from back home, the income from which they used to pay for the house. Remember, at this time, Philadelphia was a Jim Crow city, and the hotels and white boarding houses would not put up a black man or woman. And though housing needs were met initially by folks putting up their country cousins, there were just too many of us. We were sprawling out all over the place. With the growing use of automobiles, the whites were moving farther out of the city into new developments in the Northeast and out there on the main line, opening the miles upon miles of row houses in West and North Philadelphia to the black newcomers.
It's a funny thing, but in the South, owning your own home was considered a very important thing. In Philadelphia, it wasn't.
Isidore Martin.
When I was a young man and going around to visit people, I used to visit some homes of very nice people who lived in South Philadelphia. Families had been there for years, and you thought they owned the house, but they'd been renting for 20, 30, or 40 years. They would hand the lease down from father to son, literally. But I mean, that is an actual fact. And my father said many times, the native Philadelphians would say, no, don't you buy, those prices are too high. And they tried to discourage newcomers from buying, but they bought anyway. They wanted to know, this is mine. Nobody can say, Your rent's being raised or you have to move.
And then New York, you couldn't buy property.
Utensi Hillian.
And we wanted to be in a place where we could buy a home. We'd been accustomed to our own homes. And we wanted to be in a city where we could buy a home. And that's why we came to Philadelphia.
West Philadelphia became the land of sun porches, potted palms, and second mortgages. Starting in the early 1910s, the cream of the colored race settled west of 52nd Street and north of Market. Young men and women doing housework often preferred and found it easier to rent rooms in the more heavily black areas in South and in North Philadelphia, the latter then fast becoming the third largest black community in the nation. Diamond Street in the North, Christian Street in the South, and 57th Street in West Philadelphia all contained their residences of prominent families. There was resistance to black encroachment in white neighborhoods. Philadelphia did have its own riot in the summer of 1918 when Mrs. Bond moved into a house on the 2900 block of Ellsworth Street. But on the whole, there wasn't much trouble. People tended to get along better then than they do now. Though you might pay a bit more for houses than your white counterparts, they were still affordable. People settled on in pretty well.
Trouble getting here?
Trouble.
I come here for the rail. And then I got in an electrified car. And there was two little white boys sitting one corner of the car. And one of them little boys says, get on to the big fat thing. The other boy said, that old gal looks like she's full of eat. I said, look here, Mr. White Boy. If your mother had to eat a eat cake before you was born, you'd have been better bred.
Some of the newcomers were loud and boisterous in public. Dressed in their overalls and homespun clothes, these greenhorns were altogether ignorant of the ways of the city. And many, too, freed from the oppression of the South and full of illusions about the North being a land of freedom and promise, did things and behaved in ways that were considered, well, kind of inappropriate, both by Philadelphia's native black population and by the white majority. So what were they like in the eyes of the Philadelphians? Mrs. E. was industrial secretary for the Armstrong Association during the 1920s.
Well, the most of them were black in color. Some of them were belligerent. Some of them were mean. But the majority of them was yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. They didn't know anything else but that. See, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And, you know, and I'd laugh because some of them were older than myself and calling me yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And they were a nice sort of Negroes, but they were desperate for a job. But they were nice people, but they were scared people, and they were dumb people, to an extent.
Well, they did stand out. My grandmother, God rest her soul, she was a slave, but an unlettered, but she had her stiff-necked qualities, Puritan qualities, you know, and she would see some of these people come here. At that time, you see, there was an aristocracy among blacks, middle class and whatnot, that came from way before then. I see there was a well-established black population in Philadelphia. And, of course, these people that were churchgoers and all that and didn't go to these pool halls and dances and things like that, they looked askance at these other people that came in. And my grandmother, I still remember it, and I used to wince every time she said, these new niggas, and with the contempt, you know, if you see that on a face, ooh, boy, that would just be it.
Oh,
travelers.
Let a cheer the weary traveler. Let a cheer the weary traveler along the lonesome road.
Philadelphia's native black population were noted for their cultural and educational attainments. When the Great Migration began, the nation was being swept by a rising tide of racial segregation and Jim Crow. And quite naturally, the OPs, as the old black Philadelphia families were known, feared the loss of the small advantages they did enjoy and the further deterioration of their already tenuous relations with the white world. And much of the blame for the growing discrimination took shape in their minds in the form of the rule Joe Bow. In 1921, Sadie Tanner Mozell, born into one of Philadelphia's prominent Negro families, became the first black woman in America to earn a doctorate. This for her survey of the living standards of 100 migrant families.
They found suddenly thrown in their midst about 40,000 migrants whose presence in such large numbers crushed and stagnated the progress of Negro life. The processes of assimilation which the colored citizens are carrying on cannot immediately bring back the pendulum, which has swung to a position of depressed social, economic, and moral life. Only gradually, as the weights of ignorance, lack of culture, and increased racial prejudice aroused by the white people against the whole Negro citizenry as a result of the tremendous increase in the size of the Negro population are removed, will the pendulum return to normal? Certainly none of us can deny that the migration retarded the steady march of progress of the colored people in Philadelphia.
Though some OPs did become involved in providing help and assistance to the thousands of newcomers, as a group they were hesitant to assist their brethren in the rough or to accept them into their ranks. John Summers, grandson of an AME bishop in Ohio, came to Philadelphia in 1918.
The old Philadelphia Negro, and he was clannish as they could be, and they were reluctant to accept the Southern Negro, and it was a long time before they really did.
Disillusionment struck many when they found that much of Philadelphia was just like the South, strictly Jim Crow. There had been a state equal rights bill passed in 1887, but that was never really enforced. As a young man, Charles Vance came to Philadelphia in 1921 in search of his father.
Well, my first impression of Philadelphia was pretty bad for a while, because they always talk about what the South has done. And I said, now, what the South has done is true, it's no good. But I said, now look, in Philadelphia, yeah, it was restaurant share, you couldn't go and eat. It was beer gardens, yeah, out there, the somebody mentioned. You go in there and buy a glass of beer, and as soon as you finish drinking, they throw the glass in the trash. I think the people don't realize that, but that's true. The only difference I know it was, they wouldn't bother you. Nobody bothered, but they didn't care for you.
Downtown, no hotel would lodge or restaurant serve a black. Theaters were segregated by sections. There were certain neighborhoods, like Gray's Ferry, that if you had any sense at all, you would just stay clear of. Rents were consistently higher than they were for other groups. Trades that were open to black craftsmen in the South refused to admit them here.
Down in the South, we were humiliated and persecuted. We weren't allowed to do anything. We weren't allowed to even have an ambition down the South. And of course, when those people came up here, they had that same thing in their minds that I had, that when we crossed the Mason and Dixon line, we would get our justice. That's the way they said it.
William Brown.
And of course, they thought they could be just embraced right in the city, just coming from a farm without refurbishing themselves at all, and when they didn't get that, they resented it, you see, and that's what gave the impression that they were this and they were that, and it wasn't a desirable zone. I said, I know that was true. I said, but I thought a person would stand on their own record or on their own personality. I didn't think that they had to be corralled and everybody put into one basket and pushed aside like the white people did, because anybody that was black, they figured all of us were the same way.
I didn't have any clothes. I didn't have no more clothes than a Mexican dog.
All I had was a bathing suit and a pair of roller skates.
As was noted at the time, blacks were the only group in the country judged by the lowest representatives of their race, and it was Cicerettta and George Washington Jefferson Madison Jones, the rough, exuberant, shiftless, ignorant, gin-drinking, pool-playing Joe Bo, who represented the Southern black in the popular imagination. In the coming decades, the thousands of Southerners pouring into the city would transform Philadelphia physically and socially. It was the Southerners who would buy homes in West Philadelphia and make North Philadelphia the third largest black community in the country. They would form the population base large enough to support new black businesses, fight the city's political establishment, and help break the Republican machine that had run Philadelphia since the 1880s. And be leaders in the overthrow of Jim Crow in the city and the state. But those early years were difficult. They faced tremendous discrimination, social and economic, and had to overcome many obstacles. The great majority of people who made the trip north led quiet and private lives. They clung to the church, worked hard, saved what they could, educated their children, and blended into the urban landscape. And all in all, most did prefer life in the city to the life of the farm.
Well, we liked the city. We liked the city.
James Plunkett.
Because my brother-in-law was telling me a joke. He was riding around in Philadelphia, and he passed the house there, and a woman standing in the door, we knew her, coming up away from her home. And my sister says, no, son, that Maud's standing in the door, and they're on Christian Street. He backed his car back and was talking with Maud, and she says, Maud, how you like here? Oh, Francis, fine. Francis said, well, why don't you come out to see me sometime? No, you live way out in the country. I said, no, I live here in the city. I like the city. I don't want no parts of the country. And she was born to build on a tobacco farm, wheat farm. And she asked, she got married, got grown, and had kids. They come to Philadelphia, and she just tore all the pieces about Philadelphia. No, Fanny, I can't come out to see you. Well, you live out in the country. He says, I can't leave the city. Too dark out there. Too dark.
October 7th, 1917. I take this method of thanking you for your early responding and the glorious effect of the treatment. Oh, I do feel so fine, Doctor. I am now housekeeping again. I like it so much better than rooming. I am now, with the aid of God, I am making very good. I make $75 a month. I am carrying enough insurance to pay me $20 per week if I am not able to be on duty. I don't have to work hard. Don't have to Mr. Every Little White Boy Comes Along. I haven't heard a white man call a colored a nigger, you know, now since I've been in the state of Pennsylvania. I can ride in electric street and steam cars anywhere I get a seat. I don't care to mix with white folks. What I mean, I'm not crazy about being with white folks, but if I have to pay the same fare, I have to learn to want the same accommodation. And if you are first in a place here shopping, you don't have to wait until the white folks get through trading. Yet, amid all this, I shall ever love the good old South. And I am praying that God may give every well-wisher a chance to be a man, regardless of his color. And if my going to the front would bring about such accommodations, I am ready any day. The kids are in school every day. I have only two, and I guess that is all. Doctor, when you find the time, I would be delighted to have a word from the good old home state. The wife joins me in sending love to you and yours. I am your friend and patient.
All the people will be singing, glory, glory to the Lamb. Everybody will be happy over there.
Going North, Tales of the Great Migration. was conceived, written, and produced by Charles Hardy. Narration by Reverend Marshall Lorenzo Shepherd, Jr. Engineered by Leonard Persky at Toucan Productions in Philadelphia. The interview with Ella Lee recorded by Diane Turner. William Brown recorded by Donna DeVore. Readings by Millicent Sparks and Nathaniel Rory. Phonograph recordings courtesy of David Goldenberg, Dennis Mercer, Doug Seroff, and Rush Shore. This is a public history project of the Atwater Kent Museum. Funding was made possible by grants from the Pennsylvania Humanities Council and the following contributors, the Mellon Bank and Merck, Sharp, and Dohme.
This program is made possible in part by a grant from the American Public Radio Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.